glories to the symbol devotees, all glories to the symbol devotees, all glories to the symbol devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga, glories to Srila Prabhupada. I want to say that I have in my room one of these recording devices, very small, that somebody left here. Anyone missing such a thing? It's a little small silver thing. Anyway, it's in my room. I'll keep it there till someone comes and claims it. So, yesterday we began a new section about relationship and attachment, and we'd like to know, first of all, if there's any questions on anything we covered yesterday. Yes.
I have a further question on what you were talking about the mind and the emotions.
Yes.
I was thinking about what you were saying.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if it is that when we're referring to the mind in the mode of, or like as in the Bhagavad Gita, and then the mind as in the mode of passion that was described later in the Bhagavatam, is it that the pure intelligence or the it's next to the soul is probably just the super soul, really, isn't it?
Yes, actually, you can think of it this way. Comparing fire with the sun. So, the fire on this earth, its origin is the sun. So, we use fire in our own way. You know, we cook, we heat our house, we various things, fire, electricity, we put to use in our human world. But that original fire, the sun, without which we could not live, even if we had all things here for generating our own heat supply, if the sun went out, we'd be finished. So that's the original fire, that's the original intelligence. So that is the super soul. So this intelligence that is classified in the mode of passion just for working the senses, that's an emanation, that's Paramatma is giving that according to karma and ruchi. We've got this body by karma, and in this body we have a ruchi, a taste for what we like to do, what we don't like to do. So then accordingly the Lord makes intelligence available. So and we see, you can without even bringing in other forms of life, we can see how a small child, little child, has the intelligence of a little child. I mean, a little child is not what we call an intellectual, but there is some intelligence there, a recognizable intelligence of a small child, because all small children more or less, they act the same way, more or less. You know, there's basic patterns of behavior, of expression, of getting what they want, things to do, you know. And then one starts to see with age how that intelligence, more intelligence is given as the body changes. As the body changes, as the child matures, then also the tastes, more tastes become revealed, what this child likes, you know, the path this child is going to take in life. Like in India, they even have this ceremony where they offer a book or some coins at a certain age to see which direction the child, that's according to the child's taste. I often think of my good friend Murari Gupta. His youngest child is Sudevi. He has three boys, older boys, and the youngest is a daughter. So he told me how the boys, when they were growing up, they didn't care what they wore. You know, just throw on a t-shirt and some pants or something, gumshi even, and go out and play. Go out and play with the friends out in the yard. But little Sudevi, even when she's like 3, 4, her mother has to lay the clothes out before her. And she picks, I'll wear this, you know. She's only, now she's 6, something like that. But she's already got this feminine taste, you know, this feminine sense that she should look good. And he said this started when she was as young as 3. But it was there. So this is intelligence coming from, again, karma and ruchi. I mean, it comes from Krishna, but according to our karma, that means the type of body we have, and ruchi, our taste. So this is in the mode of passion. This is human affairs intelligence, you see. But then the source of that intelligence, the Paramatma, that is the sun, and Paramatma is the sun, and the brilliance streaming out of the sun is that intelligence with which we should connect in Buddha Yoga. And that intelligence is only available through specific sources, Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. We could say the principle of guidance, superior, say, abstract guidance. I use the word abstract in this sense that it is not obvious to the senses or even the mind. Because the mind is that field in which all the senses channel their information, and then we form a picture of the world in the mind. But then the mind is responding to that basically just out of taste, just, you know, this sensation is nice, so the mind goes there. This sensation is not nice, so the mind goes away from there. So what I mean by abstract is that there are higher principles, higher, like laws, for example. Just to use something that's within the realm of common human experience. There are laws, and the laws are encoded. They're in law books. But they're also like traffic laws. They're encoded in the form of a traffic signal. Now, if you don't have appropriate intelligence, you don't know. You see this thing hanging there from the wires in the middle of the road, and it's flashing red, yellow, green again. What is it? You don't know. Or something as simple as a clock. This clock on the wall. What is it? If you don't have the intelligence to recognize it, it means nothing to you. You see. So my point is that intelligence is essentially one thing. You see, the power of abstract knowledge that I learned to read this clock, and in this way I get an experience through this clock of something very abstract, which is time. Your time is one of the 5 principles taught in Bhagavad Gita. You know, time is a real abstraction. Time is considered imperceptible because we age, but we don't notice. You know, it's just one day you look in the mirror and you go, "Oh my God, what happened?" You know, but you don't see it day by day. You don't notice it, how you're aging day by day. But so it's mysterious, time. But we get a conception of time when we learn to read a clock. That requires intelligence. We need intelligence to understand what a street light means, or what a stop sign means. Or I gave the example yesterday of the skull and crossbones on a bottle. You know, that it's a symbol, and the word poison. That requires intelligence. But spiritual intelligence is that abstract guidance that leads you out of this material world, out of the cycle of birth and death, reveals the soul. Vigyan helps you discriminate, because that's essentially what intelligence is discrimination. So the spiritual intelligence, the sun-like intelligence, by that you discriminate between body and soul, between Krishna and Maya. This activity is going to send me to hell, this activity will take me back home, back to Godhead. You see? But even in the ordinary intelligence, there's discrimination. Red light, I have to stop. Green light, I go. To the mind, they're just colors. Even just to the mind itself. The mind's thing will be to say, that's a very nice shade of green. Boy, I should get a shirt that color. I really like that green. Because the mind is the center of taste. But in the mind alone, there will be no idea that green means go or that red means stop. You see? That's the buddhi. You see? But you can understand in material life, the mind takes precedence over the buddhi because the buddhi is serving the mind, serving the mind's tastes. You see? The mind wants to enjoy, so the buddhi becomes an adjunct to the mind. The mind gets in the... I'll never forget this. I read somewhere a quote by, you know, this famous filmmaker, Woody Allen. So someone asked him, why do you live in New York? He said, because New York is the only city where I can wake up at 2 in the morning and I want wanting wonton soup. And there'll be a restaurant close enough for me to walk to where I can get that. You know, so, and it means sense gratification 24 hours a day. You know, that's why I live in New York. Any desire at any time I can get satisfied. So, that's where material intelligence goes. You know, that's where it's invested. To make all these nice arrangements. You know, high technology, cars, streets, plumbing, you know, underground sewage channels, skyscrapers, airplanes, television. All this is product of intelligence, but it's simply aimed at one thing, satisfying the senses and thus satisfying the mind. You see? And this again, you see, in a philosophical sense, then we can see, you know, I always find it ironic because the mind is actually, I mean, we all have a mind, and that's the feminine side of ourself. And the intelligence is the masculine side. The intelligence is allowed to develop properly, then becomes very, you know, orderly and, you know, analytical, and the intelligence will say, you know, don't act on this now, wait till later. You know, you don't have enough money, don't spend your money now, save it, you know, do some austerities for the time being. If intelligence is strong, even in material life, that's how it acts. Whereas the mind is more, you know, directly plugged into the senses. And it's, you know, it's just like a mother and her children, you know. The children are the senses of the children of the mind, and the senses are bawling, you know, I want this, I want that. And the mind is going, all right, dear. And then the mind is going to intelligence, look, you know, this sense wants this object. And if the intelligence is strong, you know, this is not the time for that. You know, just like when we're in the Bhagavatam class. Then the stomach might tell the mind, I'm hungry. I want to have a pizza. I want to go out and... There's a Little Italy... I saw a sign for some Little Italy pizzeria, so... I hear they open early, and I want to go there and have a pizza. And then the mind turns to the intelligence. Little stomach G is crying for a pizza. The intelligence says, this is not the time for that. We have to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a class going on. So worry about that later. And so then the mind tells... See, if everything's in order, then the mind tells the stomach, sorry, I'm sorry, dear. You can't have your pizza now. You have to wait. You see? So we have everyone, even if you're, you know, Brahmachari Sannyasi, we have our own little griha going on inside. And you see, in material life, just like in material life, Srila Prabhupada says, basically, woman is the center. You see, even after all is said and undone about women's rights and all this agitation, women are the ones running the world. It's a fact. All the men are busy running around making money to try to please women so they can have sex with them. You know, and the women are doling out the sex according to what they get from the men. You know, well, if you give me a better car, then I might say yes. You know, otherwise, if you're going to just pick me up in that old 69 Volkswagen, forget about it. Don't call me, I'll call you. That's the way the world works. And so it is also inside. That materialism means that the mind is the dominant principle. And intelligence is just serving the mind. The mind gets its whims. Like Woody Allen, you know. I wake up at 2 in the morning and I want some one, you know, I don't even know what that is. It's some kind of Chinese soup. Well, I want some Chinese food, you know. And that's why he lives in New York, because he can get it. You know, even waking up in the middle of the night, he can get his Chinese buffet, you know. So, just living to satisfy the mind and the sensual urges. So that's material life. So, with that booty, you can't disentangle yourself. That booty is enslaved. That booty is Rajoguna, product of Rajoguna. You see? So therefore, Buddhi Yoga, we have to connect with Krishna's intelligence, and that comes from specific sources. Guru Shastra Sadhu. You see? And that's like the sun. Isn't that? Krishna says in the Gita, when you receive this knowledge, then it lights up everything. You see? It illuminates everything. Where our knowledge is like fire, you know, it's limited. I get a little illumination to do the practical things, or the heat to do the practical things that we need to do to keep this body going. And that's all we use it for. So this is actually what I told you is actually very profound. I presented it in simple everyday terms, but when you study the Vedas, a repeated theme in the Vedas is Surya, Soma and Agni. This is again and again and again and again. It comes up in so many ways. So Surya means the sun, Soma means the moon, which represents the mind, and Agni is fire, the fire of sacrifice. And that's also the fire of digestion, because one should only eat yagyashishta, you know, the remnants of sacrifice. And the fire is actually an expansion of the same principle of Agni, fire of digestion, I mean. Digestion is simply the same expansion of Agni into the body. And so by the Agni principle, we do sacrifices to keep our life going here in the material world. That's classical, in the classical Vedic sense. We're doing these sacrifices, fire sacrifices, for our own purposes. Whereas the sun and the moon, these are celestial. These are higher, of higher order. So, the light of the sun is calming and peaceful, it's sensuous. The light of the moon, calming, peaceful and sensuous, where the light of the sun can be very strong, very irresistible. You know. That's the intelligence, the way the intelligence should be. Very powerful. And so much I'm talking about the original Vedic, you know, four Vedas, so much about this triad of Surya, Soma and Agni. So I just explained all that in very common day-to-day language. But these are the principles of intelligence, mind, and the local intelligence that we use for our own human affairs. Anything else? Yes.
Yesterday you said about the connection between brain, mind and objects of senses.
Yes.
But at the same time you said that our desires are going from deeper resources. Yeah. And also when we sleep, our mind walk, but it has no connection with external objects. Does it have any connection in? Does it mean that this connection is not necessary?
Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, lust resides in the senses and in the mind and intelligence. So all three are places where we can develop attachment. You see? Mm-hmm. So you can develop attachment to by the senses coming in contact with their sense objects. That can be a focal point for very strong attachment. Mm-hmm. But you can become attached just to an image in the mind. Or you can even become attached to the intelligence itself. You see? The intelligence can conceive of plans of sense gratification, elaborate plans for sense gratification. It begins up there. You see, and then works its ways down into the mind and into the senses from the intelligence. So all three are possible. Anything else? All right, so now we ended yesterday, we were talking about the puzzling nature of attachment. We were raising the question of how do we become attached to things, because as we already saw, those of you who saw the film, for example, sense perception is a mystery. Sense perception is bewildering. It's bewildering to understand. It's actually very insubstantial, you see. And so we just gave the example of the smell of puris, that because we're devotees, and because we live in a certain way, we're in a sense conditioned in the mode of goodness, and we live in a community, so there's this thing called consensus reality, it's called. There's objective reality, which nobody, if they're on the platform of senses and mind, is in touch with, actually. Objective, which means what's really out there. There's another thing, consensus reality. It means as a group we agree. We agree that certain things are true and certain things are false. And that's the way human society mostly works. Even in ISKCON. Because, you know, we don't have the greatest realization of Krishna, most of us. So we, in a sense, move with the group. And we form our opinions on, but this is valid, because one pleases Krishna by pleasing the Vaishnavas. So if the general Vaishnava opinion of a question is this, we should follow it. We should not, it's not wise to be at loggerheads with too many other devotees, you see. And there's danger of creating offenses and so on and so forth. But consensus reality, just because, you know, it doesn't chase away the spook of the question of whether there's any real substance to what we perceive. Because we may all agree as devotees that smelling, you know, the smell of fried puris is a very nice smell. But as I said, there's a whole nation one country over, Burma, where many of the people would disagree. It all turned, whoa, what is that smell? Horrible. And they like 3-year-old fish sauce. So there's so many. This is an issue, a big issue in philosophy and a big issue in psychology. And this helps us, just going over this helps us then to put our attachments into perspective. Because we struggle with attachments even after we become devotees. But then if you can really just consider what are these things, like I said, the intelligence creates its own attachments. So an aspect of intelligence is memory. Smriti, there's five aspects of intelligence. So one of them is smriti, memory. So we have thoughts of some, I gave this example yesterday, memories of some girl we knew 25 years ago. Well, where is she now? I don't know. I mean, she certainly doesn't look like she does. She looked then, she doesn't look like that now. But still, you know, these fond memories will come in through the intelligence. And then we find ourselves wasting time imagining, oh, if it was, you know, 1969 again, and if only I had said this to her instead of that, and if only I'd worn my blue suit instead of my, that ridiculous bell-bottom flower shirt outfit I had on. You know? Because I think she was really the girl for me. You know, but all you have is just a memory. And what is that memory? You see? And what is this perception that we have? So now Nitai Gauranga is going to, from the Western side of psychology, going to present some of the anomalies of memory, of perception, the anomalies that riddle perception, to help us understand how ephemeral, how unsubstantial sense perception is, and therefore how rather ridiculous it is to take it so seriously that we develop strong attachments to sense objects. So I turn everything over to him. Thank you.
Okay. So this is the part where we get into the nuts and bolts of material attachment, and my contribution to this is going to be from the Western scientific realm of the wild world of perception. I took a perception class in college, and other classes I touched on too. One class just on perception, and I was thinking, oh God, you know, I hate classes like they're just like this boring scientific things that I can't get into. But that, I swear, that perception class was really a mind-blowing experience. So I'm going to try to relay some of those interesting things here. Starting with this verse that Maharaj was talking about yesterday in the 11th canto, the idea that the material mind pervades the material sense objects, and the material sense objects pervade the material mind. It's impossible to understand where our mind ends and where the external world begins. Everything we're seeing is actually going on in our mind. So where does this thing, this image in our mind end, and where does the sense objects begin? Who can understand it? But I believe it's the four Kumaras that are making the point that there's a seamless connection between the mind and the sense objects. It's like they're just, one's an extension of the other, that they're made for each other, that they fit together so perfectly. But then the question arises, well, why do people perceive things differently? For example, this wonderful example of the Burmese people not liking the smell of puris, frying in ghee, and liking the wonderful smell that comes from the jar of 3-year-old fish oil. So, there is an interesting line in one of these verses from the Uddhava Gita that says, sense objects in the form of desire enter within the mind. What I get from that verse is that when we have a perception of a sense object, We have a perception of something in the objective world that it's qualified by desire, that it's qualified, it's characterized. We characterize it either as desirable or not desirable, or somewhere in the spectrum between desirable and not desirable. Therefore, people have different views of the objective world. There is one objective world, but we have a subjective understanding of it based on desire, and I would say even further, based on our psychophysical natures, our bodily constitutions, our different biological needs. For example, we were talking one day about how the perceptual system of a frog, the visual perceptual system of a frog, is very different from the visual perceptual system of a human. That certain things as humans catch our eyes, they strike us as important. Other things may kind of just, you might just miss them if you're not looking directly at them. So a frog, for example, has a perceptual system that's specifically set up to see little dots that go back and forth like this, because this is what a frog calls food. These are flies going back and forth, and so the frog can swing his tongue out there and catch the fly, and everyone's happy.
You understand that?
Well, not the fly, but the frog's happy.
It's exactly like a radar screen. That's a frog's field of visual consciousness. It doesn't see anything else except the fly. Whether it even sees the fly as we see the fly is a question.
Right.
You know, it might just see it as some kind of glowing dot or something, just moving around. And because it doesn't see anything else, then when it flicks its tongue, it catches the fly, because there's just nothing else to distract it. And so they've done laboratory tests, and they found that this is how a frog's vision works. So and you can understand how a human being who dedicates himself with great energy, enthusiasm, and determination to sense gratification, you're just seeing the world as the object of a sense gratification, can end up in such a body.
Well, here's an interesting example, really interesting. There is a famous baseball player in America named Ted Williams. I don't know what team Ted Williams is on.
Boston.
He was on. Okay, thank you very much. I'm from Boston. If I didn't know, I would have got burned to the stake for not knowing that. People in Boston are very fanatical about baseball. Ted Williams told people that when he was at bat, he would see the seams on the baseball coming at him. It's not just a white blur coming at him at 100 miles an hour, but he would actually be so concentrated that he would see the individual seams on the baseball. He was a damn good hitter, so I guess, he was highly concentrated and it paid off.
He actually proved that. I forget how.
Oh, really?
It's so outlandish and so impossible that he was challenged, and I forget the detail, but he proved it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, what do you know?
I think it was something like the bat was painted, and if he struck a ball, he would say whether he struck it on the seam or on the actual hide.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's some pretty serious concentration. There is a verse in the Brihat Aranyaka Upanishad that states, I don't know the Sanskrit, please forgive me, but the verse states that it's giving a commentary on this idea of attention and the role that plays in perception. And it says, someone may say, I did not see it, my mind was elsewhere. Or, I did not hear that, my mind was elsewhere. And then it says, indeed, things are, objects are seen with the mind, and objects are heard with the mind. So, further, in the Vedic understanding of psychology, I said this once before, but I'll go through it again. It's an interesting point that there's three aspects of perception. There is the physics, the physiology, and the psychology. So, the physics refers to the external sense objects. So, we give an example of my computer here. This is what we call the physics. It has a physical form. It radiates a certain amount of energy through electromagnetic energy, what we call light. It has a certain shape. It has a certain feeling. You know, it drives me crazy because it doesn't do the things that I want it to do. So that's the physics of this machine. Then the physiology, in the case of seeing it, is the eyes. In the case of feeling it, is the sense of touch. And then there's the psychology. The person who's perceiving it, what is their psychological disposition. Oh, that's weird. Just one coming along. Their psychological disposition towards this machine. So with physiology, let's say that I have trichromatic vision. I have a full normal human spectrum of vision. Someone who is colorblind, you know, I put something with interesting colors on the screen, and they might miss some of the colors. They might miss all of the colors and just see entirely in black and white. So in that case, due to the physiology, people are having two different perceptions of it. And then more importantly is due to the psychology, that people have different perceptions of it. Your psychological need or want of a computer. I have a friend who loves computers, so he might pick out the smallest things about the computer, can understand so much about it. I hate computers. I hate this machine. And so it just looking at it kind of gives me a visceral reaction, just, oh, geez, you know, this thing has just caused me so much pain and headache, and just, you know, get it out of my face. So based on those three things, or namely the two, of the physiology and the psychology, we have different perceptions of the one objective external sense object. So that is why the Bengali will smell the puris and think, oh, how wonderful, and the Burmese person will smell it and think this is just horrendous. That they have a different different psychological need, or they have a certain identity, and that puri fits into that identity or doesn't fit into that identity. So within the identity of being a Bengali, puris are something. I grew up eating puris. This may, you know, have so many memories for me eating puris with my family and whatnot. And for a Burmese person, it's not necessarily like that. Or for maybe some of us, you know, the smell of puris reminds us of the first Sunday feast we went to. Or I remember it. One of the first Sunday feasts I went to, I was thinking how good the puris were, and I told someone how much I liked them, and they gave me a huge plastic bag full of puris, and I just had them next to my bed, and I just sit in my bed eating, just playing puris all day. But then, getting more into the physiology of it, we can say that a stronger perception will fade out or occlude a weaker perception. So for example, we look in the sky right now and we see a big blue, well, bluish, whitish kind of thing. Because the sun is in the sky, we don't see any stars. When the sun goes down, there's going to be so many stars. But the stars are also there right now. But due to the light of the sun is a stronger perception than that of the stars, then we don't see the stars. So a stronger perception can fade out of a weaker perception. And in certain cases, what is stronger and what is weaker isn't necessarily based on the physiology of it. It is based on our psychological
disposition.
Disposition, that's weird. It just doesn't come out right. I know this word. Funny.
You start saying it. Why would it happen?
It's weird. It just halfway through just doesn't come. Disposition. Okay, I got it now. There is our psychological disposition towards a sense object will judge it as stronger or weaker, and then therefore we may perceive it or not perceive it. An interesting example of this is what is called the cocktail party phenomena. So I can give you an example of it. Let's say you're at a... Okay, we're devotees. We don't go to cocktail parties. So We'll change the name to the Feast of the Big Kitchen phenomena. So we're at a feast at the Big Kitchen, and the humongous airplane hangar type building, and there's, you know, a couple hundred devotees in there. And so we're sitting in there, and we're having a conversation with one of our friends. And there's, you know, we're near the kitchen, so there's people yelling at each other in Bengali, and then they bring these huge pots, and the pots are clanking and clanging all over the place, making a lot of noise. And there's, you know, a good 100 different conversations going on there at once. And, you know, one person is yelling, you know, you pour the dal in my gulabjamun, you know, what you ruined it. And so there's all these different things going on. You're having a conversation with your friend, and miraculously, you don't hear any of it. You don't hear the pots clanging. You don't hear the people yelling, and unless you stop to hear it. But when you're having the conversation, when you're absorbed in the conversation, you miss everything. Nothing comes in, because realistically, we're being just thrown with thousands and thousands of sense perceptions at every second. And if we were to perceive all of them, it would be quite a maddening experience. So if we're sitting and having the conversation, we hear the pots, and we hear this person yelling, and the 100 different conversations at once, it would drive you nuts. But fortunately, we don't. But at the same time, we do. We hear all of the conversations. We hear all the pots banging. We hear all the Bengalis yelling at each other. But the interesting thing is that because the conversation you're having with the person you're sitting next to is meaningful to you, therefore you don't hear any other thing, because the stronger or the more important perception fades out the other perceptions. Now, here is the interesting thing about the Feast of the Big Kitchen phenomena, as it's commonly called here in the Hare Krishna movement. Now, let's say you're having a conversation, and all of a sudden you hear from way on the other side of the big kitchen, well, maybe not way on the other side, but maybe two rows back in the big kitchen, someone mentions your name, you know, and some, you know, all of a sudden your ears perk up and you hear your name and you're thinking, you know, what the hell is that guy talking and saying about me over there? So, though before you weren't hearing that person's conversation, as soon as your name is mentioned, then your perceptual system goes away from the conversation that you're having and goes over to the two rows behind you where someone's mentioning your name. And that is what's known as the cocktail party phenomena, or the big kitchen phenomena, as we like to call it.
I'd like to just jump in here with the...
Please jump.
With a little, just a little tidbit that I think illustrates the difference between reality as we know it. I mean, in the sense of that we're actually conscious beings, and what Nitai Gauranga Prabhu has just described is a phenomena of consciousness, you see. Yes, you can be sitting in the middle of a scene like that and tune it all out, and then suddenly when someone mentions your name, you're immediately tuned into it. And we just live with this and we take it for granted. Whereas those who try to explain everything in material terms, This is really a mystery. This is a real problem for them, you know, to come up, because they have to come up with some type of mechanism, physical mechanism, which explains how this can happen. When they make films, they'll have a sound. You know, they very often have scenes in a party scene, you know, in a big restaurant, something like that. And there'll be so many tables and people sitting at the table. And there's the main characters of the film are at one table in the restaurant, and they're talking. And so when you watch the film, it's the same thing. They're talking, and in the background, you can hear little tidbits of conversation, laughter, clinking of glasses and silverware and this and that. But actually, when they film the scene in the studio, They have to. They're required. It's material nature, physical nature forces them to film that scene in total silence, except for the conversation of the main actors. So the other actors at the different tables are just sitting there, you know, making movements with their mouths and gesturing like this. It has to be total silence so that the microphone will pick up the conversation that the real actor, you know, the main actors are having with complete clarity. Because if they really filmed it with everyone talking, then it would all be a big muddle and you wouldn't hear anything. You see? So this is the same thing he was talking about, but done materially, in other words. You see? Just relying on pure physics, no consciousness, just microphone, recording apparatus. It can't be reproduced. So I once saw a documentary of a film being made, and they actually showed this. So you saw some rather well-known Hollywood actors, and they're sitting at one table in a big set, which is like a club. And you actually saw them, they're talking, and you could see the mic booms above their head. And all around there's these other actors, and they're all going in complete silence. And then they add the soundtrack later, you see. And they adjust it. They adjust the soundtrack so that you can focus on what the main actors are saying. But we do that automatically. Consciousness automatically does it. They have to set up a whole elaborate apparatus because they're working with gross matter, trying to reproduce something that we do every day without even thinking of it, without trying. Consciousness does that. So I just wanted to add that as a kind of like interesting insight. And this is one of the big problems of the material explanation of everything, you see. Continue.
Okay.
Please.
Okay, I handed out this little piece of paper. Now, I have different theories here, and I'm not sure how effective this will be. Now, I want everyone to read what's on this piece of paper just to themselves. We'll give you about 3 seconds to read it. Okay, time's pretty much up. Now, I want you to count how many times the letter F is in this paper. And I'll give you another 3 seconds. Count how many Fs. Okay, now, how many people here, I went by a show of hands, how many people had the piece of paper with 3 Fs on it? Okay. How many people have the piece of paper with 4 Fs on it? How many people have the piece of paper with 5 Fs on it? How many people have the piece of paper with 6 Fs on it? Okay. Now, funny thing is, these are all the same pieces of paper. They all have the same thing written on them. And actually, there are 6 Fs in this. You can count them again. It worked.
Now he's happy.
I wasn't sure if it's going to work, but it actually did. Because the word of sounds like a V, we hear it in our head phonetically, and when we read words, we really just scan over them. There's been tests shown that you can flip letters around, and you'll it's practically impossible to pick it up. Keep trying again. Keep trying. But this is an interesting... Keep trying. This is an interesting example of how attention affects perception. That to the extent that we have attention to something, to detail, what have you, to that extent we will be able to perceive something. And to the extent that we aren't paying attention to something, to that extent something will go way over our head. Now I have another fun example. We'll have to all come a little closer, gather around my little computer here.
Come in.
And this will be a good time too, I promise. Now, if you know the answer to this, don't yell it out and ruin it for everyone else. Just don't read the side because that'll ruin it too. Just go with it. Have fun. Now, I want everyone to... Everyone can see? Kinda? Try to get it close. And if someone's in the back and they want to experience this the first hand, we can do it after class too. It's a fun thing. Now, I want everyone to focus on one of the yellow dots. Everyone's looking at one of the yellow dots right now. Okay, so is anything going on with the yellow dots?
Some of them are, the other ones are appearing and disappearing.
Okay, you jumped the gun, but I guess it happens like that too. But the point is, this is, okay, you've got this thing spinning around, but the yellow dots are stationary, the green dot is blinking. Now, if everyone stares at the green dot, everyone stare at the green dot intensely. Just stare at that green dot, watch it blink on and off, and what happens?
It speeds up and slows down. The grid, moving grid.
No, the moving grid is staying
the same.
They begin to appear and disappear because when our attention isn't focused on them, it becomes kind of like, well, you know, your mind is thinking the important thing is the green dot. Look at the green dot, and you know the yellow dot. Is it there? It's kind of there. Oh wait, is the yellow dot? It's there. Oh wait, and then you're thinking green dot, then the yellow dot kind of disappears, and oh wait, is the yellow dot still there? Yeah, it's still there. So that's kind of basically what's going on in this fun exercise.
Sometimes not all of them disappear. Actually.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So based on our perception, we see certain things, and certain things can just disappear and just be unnoticeable. I have another fun one that's totally not connected, but this is just a damn neat one. I'm just going to show it to you, okay?
Don't hate these computers too much.
Okay, now I want someone to please don't read the sign, and if you know it, don't ruin it. I want someone to make a statement about these two tabletops, a statement about the relationship between the two tabletops, just the tops of the tables, and not that they're different colors, besides that they're different colors. Someone want to make a statement.
The table on the left is higher than the table on the right.
Okay, but just about the top, the surface itself.
The right one is more white.
Right. So, okay. Okay, now we're going to have a fun little thing here.
What did he say? Say this.
One is fat, one is thin, one is rectangular, one is square.
Sizes.
Now watch this. This is going to be mind-blowing, I promise. We press this button here, and the tabletop is moving, and this one's moving over to this table. And what is going to happen? My goodness, it appears as if they're the same damn tabletop, and we just looked at them, and they look completely different. Now, I can even show you, like this, that it's not, the thing is not changing. It's the same shape. You spin it around. It looks the same. It's the same shape. There it is like that. There it is like that.
Amazing.
It's actually the same shape. Now, the reason this works is because this is kind of the difference between perception and cognition. Perception is really the raw gathering of information, and cognition is what we make of it. And so in this case, where it's a two-dimensional picture, and we're seeing it, we're understanding that this is actually a three-dimensional thing. This is actually it's a representation of three dimensions. And so in three dimensions, this table would be longer, and this table would be shorter and fatter. But perceptually, we're seeing things exactly the same. They're appearing on the retina as the same image, but we're distorting them based on our understanding of depth, in this case. Interesting and fun, huh? Okay. Now I just have one more point to make about one study, another study. Everyone can take their seats again. Now the last thing I wanted to point out was an experiment on what is called dichotic presentation. Dichotic presentation means that you have two different stimuli going into two different ears. So what they did was called a shadowing test. So they'll say, we're going to play something. The person has headphones on. They're saying, we're going to place something into your left ear. Now, what I want you to do is when you hear it, you recite it back. So they would do that. They place something into the left ear, and as you're hearing it, you're reciting it back. So you must give, you must give 250 rupees, 250 rupees. So you're back, as you're hearing it, you're reciting it. And simultaneously, after a couple seconds of the shadowing, you're saying it, you're hearing in left ear, you're saying it. After a couple seconds, they start to put something into the right ear of the same volume. So it's an equal stimulus, nothing is occluding the other one, they're both equally as loud. And so what might be coming into the right ear is someone reading a translation of the Bhagavad Gita in English, and then they go to the Bhagavad Gita in French, and then into German, and then they just start talking gibberish. And then, you know, so it could be any number of things. And at the end, what they would do is they would play the recording that was going into the right ear to the person and say, "Does this mean anything to you?" The person would say, "No, I've never heard that before. You've never heard this before, never heard it before." And then they would tell them, actually, while you were doing this shadowing thing, this was going into your right ear. But because the attention was directed onto the left ear and what was coming into the left ear, that what was going into the right ear was completely just disregarded and unheard by the participant. Now, it gets a little more interesting in that they started doing it like this. So I will use the chalkboard for this one.
Model of the sunbeam and get rid of that. So you've got you've got this fella here, and here's his big head. He's got two ears. Here's his left ear. Here's his right ear. His eyes, and it's happy. Keep going. So in the left ear they have the message that's supposed to be shadowed. So they're reciting something into this, something is going into this ear, and he's speaking it as it comes out. Now in the right ear, there is, in this case now, just a pure tone. So it's just a beep. Beep, over and over again while this message is being played. Now, here in the man's brain, are these areas here called the auditory cortex. Now, when a tone is played into the, and the tone that comes into the right ear is played into the, is played into the right ear, it's represented in a very specific area in the auditory cortex. So, beep, beep, beep comes up. You can see a little pattern going on here. Beep, 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 little flashes of electrical pulses going through the brain right here. And so the same is over here. There is something else going on over here because this is, your left ear is perceiving this. Now, when it's something that is common, that is commonly heard, the person has no trouble shadowing it. So let's say, for us, we're shadowing Srila Prabhupada's pranam mantra. We know the pranam mantra, we say it every day, we've said it every day for years and years and years, so it's not so hard to recite that. So it's coming into our ear, we're reciting it, no problem. And the beeps are coming in this ear, and then simultaneously there's the beeps, the electrical impulses for Prabhupada's pranam mantra is going on here, and then there's the electrical impulses for the beeps on this side of the brain. And so if the stimulus is common, is easy to understand, you'll also hear the beep. So afterwards they'll say, did you hear anything else going on? And they'll say, yeah, I think I heard some beeping going on. And how many times did you hear the beep? And they'll say maybe, 25 times I heard the beep. When actually it was played 100 times. So to the extent that it's easy to recite, to that extent you'll also hear something else. Now if it's something that you've never heard before, something with
higher vocabulary, that words that are harder to recite, that requires more concentration, then this is going to be firing over here. So the brain is receiving that stimulus coming in here. But because we're requiring so much concentration over here, the beeps that are coming into the right ear are no longer firing in the brain. Now the idea is that somewhere between our eardrum here and all the nerves that go into the brain and goes through the subcortical area of the brain, which means the area of the brain which deals more with instincts and impulses and things of that nature, not of higher thinking things. It's filtered out in this part of the brain. So the interesting thing of that is that we understand that our minds can only handle so much. That when we're dealing with something very difficult, we can't hear anything else. Literally, it doesn't even, it's not that we filter it out consciously. We're saying, oh, just shut up, I'm trying to concentrate on this thing. But literally, the brain filters it out, and it's not even perceived anymore. For all intents and purposes, for us, it doesn't exist. Now, the interesting implications of that is that we only can handle so much. Now, here's some interesting things. Here's some interesting imports to that. I had a professor, and I can't remember her name, but she was a real neat lady. And she told this interesting story that she had some project to do, and I can't remember what it was, but she had a lot going on, and she didn't want to deal with the project. And so there was this folder that had to do with the project. And so she had to find this folder in order to work with this project. And she was very busy. She didn't want to do it, but okay, I'll do it. And she looked for the folder and looked and looked and looked and looked, and she couldn't find that folder anywhere. So this project ended. She couldn't really make a contribution, and it was over, and all was said and done. Then the very next day, she went into the drawer of her desk. She opened the drawer, and there was her folder. And she looked in that desk, she said, probably 25 to 50 times for this folder. And it was right there in front of her the whole time. But because it was something that she couldn't handle at that time, or that she really had a desire not to see that folder, it just wasn't there. It was there physically, but she wasn't perceiving it. So another interesting example is the phenomenon of blackouts, that oftentimes when people have a traumatic experience, I think this happens a lot with car accidents, that right before someone gets into a car accident and you ask them afterwards, so what happened? So I was driving and all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. I just blacked out. I just, everything went black and I don't know what happened. The idea is that what occurred in that period of time was too much for our minds to handle, or too much for our emotional system to handle at that time. So our brain just says, okay, just don't perceive this, don't look at it, and your visual system will just shut off, and your memory of it will just shut off. And so when you would try to recall the memory, all you remember is I'm going, then everything just goes black. And then another interesting example is called, I think there's another term for it now, but it was called back in the good old days, hysterical blindness. That when someone had let's say they went through a traumatic experience that had to do with their visual system, they saw something that was so appalling to them, so difficult for them to deal with, that they started to have symptoms of what's called hysterical blindness, meaning that they started to actually go blind. And blind, not there is no physiological thing that was wrong with them, but it was a purely psychological phenomenon in that they no longer wanted to see because of what happened to them. So their visual system just shut off. And that is my first installment of the wild world of perception. And we have 13 minutes, which is an awkward amount of time to leave with.
When you say first installment,
the wild world of perception.
You're planning to speak of that.
Yeah, the next later thing on. Is on perception too, and I think
it'll
carry on.
Okay.
All right. In this section, even Brahma had no answer.
Yeah, that's okay. That's
all right. So then I'll just continue. So, all right, all these interesting points have come up, and so we want to condense them into some clearly understandable principles. So, getting back to the point of good smell, bad smell. So, also the things Nitai Gauranga has gone through, we can bring it down to an ontological, what's called in philosophy, an ontological issue. First let me explain this word. Ontological, there's two words. Ontological and epistemological. So, actually a lot of what we're doing here is epistemological. How we know things. The process, like when we talk about, like that film that we showed, or these things when we talk about how we're seeing things, seeing the yellow dots disappear, and so when they're actually still there. This is epistemology, it's called in philosophy. How the process of getting to know something. But epistemology, inevitably, because of the same point, that everything that we know is encompassed by the mind. So we can study all these mysteries and quirks and paradoxes of epistemology, the epistemology of sense perception. But finally it brings us to ontology. An ontology of the question is simply the question of what is real and what isn't. What is actually there and what isn't there. So, in these ways, the epistemological issues, questions, they mount up. And finally, the big question breaks through. Well, if I can't trust my senses and I can't trust my mind, then what am I really experiencing? You see? So getting back to the question of good smell or bad smell. So if there, and this is a common ontological question, it comes up in different forms. It's classical. If there are no noses around, connected to minds, to smell either the fried puri or the fish sauce, then does the smell exist? I mean, does that have any existence of its own? If there's nobody there to perceive it, then does the good smell or the bad smell, does it exist at all? You see? We raised a question yesterday. What would a mind be? What would we have if there was a person who never in their life, I mean, they were totally devoid of the use of any of their gyanendriyas. They were blind, they were deaf, they had no sense of taste, no sense of touch, no sense of hearing, zero. What kind of mind would they have? Would they have a mind? You see? So these are the questions that come up. So So ultimately, on the material platform, all these issues which come up again and again in psychology and philosophy, they're ultimately paradoxical. Nobody has actually come up with outside of Shastra, has come up with anything that can be called a final answer. And therefore, there's this person I quote here, Thomas Key, who lived in the 19th century. Yeah, the 1800s is called the 19th century. The 1900s is called the 20th century. So he lived in the about 200 years ago. And so he said, "What is mind? No matter. What is matter?
No mind.
Never mind." So it just ends in paradox. So they don't really know what to say. They don't really know where to draw any distinctions. What does it finally mean? They don't really know what is real and what isn't real. You see? I mean, so much of our life is, we're under the control of emotions, we're under the control of false perceptions, we're under the control of rumors. I mean, ISKCON. I'll never forget when I was on the GBC, we were talking about some question that was, becoming an issue in the society. A lot of devotees were raising the question and demanding the GBC come up with a position that can be preached to the devotees, presented as the position. So we were discussing how to deal with this. And I remember one GBC man in a sort of, matter-of-fact way, he was just saying, "Well, we devotees, after all, they think in terms of philosophy, so it shouldn't be at all difficult to establish the tattva of this. We just present the philosophy." And then another GBC just shook his head and just said, made a remark, something like, "Are we in the same movement?" He said, "My experience is devotees, mainly, the main thing that moves their minds are rumors and gossip and and conspiracy theories and and all kinds of wild, prajalpa rages through the movement for a short or long time, becomes a big, stirs everyone up, everyone gets excited, everyone gets on the computer, and then gradually it dies down and you don't hear about it, until the next thing comes along." So his point is, why bother? Because the philosophy, he was saying, because the philosophy is there, it's already there in Prabhupada's books, but they still get excited. So it's a fact of human nature. We get so stirred up about things, but that ever-present question hangs over all of it. What is reality? What is real? And what is just perception? What is just a creation of the mind? And what is actually out there? And so, the answer, at least from the material side, is paradoxical. It's just different opinions. You have different schools of thought. That's why there's different philosophers. Scientists don't agree either. They all have their different opinions. So, but let's get back to the central point that's being raised by this question of the Kumaras. This question of what is reality, we're going to deal with that a little later. We've brought it up. It's good to bring it up. It's good to remind ourselves, because we ourselves, this is about relationship and attachment. So we're always relating with this world, with other people. And we often, all the time, we find ourselves entering into, attachment, I'm using that word in a general sense. It can mean attraction or it can mean aversion. You see, you like or not like, but in either case, it's some kind of attachment. We find ourselves forming some kind of attachment with things. So it's good. This is a good thought exercise to remember, to think about what is the basis of all this. Now my mind's getting all agitated, stirred up about something. But what is actually there? You see, what is actually there? And if you know our philosophy, and if you can add it with a little bit of basic scientific knowledge too, you very quickly understand that in many cases getting stirred up over nothing. Okay, so that's good to remind ourselves of. But the main point, the main issue, is that the Kumaras are raising is that if the mind and the sense objects are always and inseparably attached to each other, because we're coming back to the central point of anyonya, this word, one another.